Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your weekly pop culture tip-off. I'm Andrew Harrison.
And I'm Sian Pattenden. This week we are delighted to have with us the gruesomely talented songwriter and musician Bernard Butler. He's the wizard of six strings, except it turns out he's a multi-instrumentalist. Bernard is here to talk about the deluxe re-release of his 98 album People Move On. We also revel in the company of our other special guest, nimble-footed broadcasting legend Katie Puckrick.
On this week's show, we're going to discuss the new BBC three-part documentary Andy Warhol's America, promising to look at the social context behind the world's most well-known pop artist.
And we listen to Night Call, the eagerly awaited album from Ollie Alexander's Years and Years. Plus, we've seen Indonesian thriller Photocopier, out now on Netflix.
All this and more on this week's Culture Bunker. Hello, welcome to the Culture Bunker. Let's say hello to our first guest. Bernard Butler is a musician, songwriter and radio host. He was also once in a certain British pop group, but we're not going to talk about the past. Hello, Bernard. Thanks for coming to our North London studio.
Hi.
By bike.
How else?
You're also a broadcaster with the BB and King show on North London's own Boogaloo Radio. Are you going to be reprimanding us for our microphone technique?
Absolutely. I'm just looking at the technical setup here and just examining it, thinking it's very lo-fi in comparison to the bin shed that is. out the back of a pub. I mean, I wouldn't call myself anything. Barely a guitar player. Getting away with it, I think.
That's a hell of a twist of mine. Barely a guitar player. Now, you're a noted Arsenal fan, and you and I will have to have an uneasy truce after last night's testy draw in the Liverpool-Arsenal game. I have to ask you about it. What's your take on Arteta? Has he got long? Is he doing all right?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's all right, yeah. I'm very happy with him. I think he's an intelligent person. I like that. Like that movement in football. I'm more worried about the fact that have you noticed how football coaches costumes or their fashion sense is now just on the streets with everybody, like, so the long zip up puffer coat that used to be something that middle aged men standing at the side of football, Sam Allardyce's for example, you know, would stand there, and now everybody's wearing these everywhere, you know. How did that happen?
You look at them and you say, are you managing a football team? Are you going to sell me 10 gaslighters for a pound? It's like, please make a decision on your sartorial, your turnout.
So I like the fact that there are some intelligent human beings in football, like Jurgen Klopp, for example.
Thank you very much.
Mikel Arteta, and I hope they do well.
As a producer, obviously, you yourself had to marshal disparate talents into a single creative unit. Could you bring these skills to the Emirates if it was required? I mean, who's the unsung bass player who really needs to get to write more songs?
Oh, my God. The funny thing is, I do think about this a lot when I'm at football. And I do think about the processes and creative process. This is going to sound really pretentious, all of it.
And I'm
happy with that, of course. But I do think about that an awful lot, about teams and about the dynamics between people. And it's because a lot of the passion and the sense of disappointment and thrill and the sense of not knowing what's going to happen, the big what if, really translates from what I do as a musician. And what I like about being a musician, what I like about my life, actually, not knowing how things are going to work out, that sense of thrill, I'm very lucky to have that sense. And that translates really well to watching football if you look at it that way. And it's also a good way of, obviously you have this ridiculous, absurd sort of rivalries between human beings that are standing 10 feet away from you. You know, people doing, and then you realise that person's going to be, you know, you're going to, they're going to come to your show tomorrow night, you know, and you may have to deal with this.
With a Tottenham shirt on under their
exactly. jumper. Exactly. Or, you know, they're going to deliver something to your door or something, and they're going to be nice people, you know. And so I like all the contradictions.
Yeah.
I like the contradictions on the pitch as well. And I like the creative, I look for the creative people, the interesting players that I'm interested in. So I'm obviously less interested in the thuggish defenders than I am in the
you like the virtuosos and the multi-instrumentalists.
I do. I like the guy in the middle that has the potential to do something unexpected and with a bit of a brain. I mean, I never talk about this with anyone, and I go to football for that reason, because I never think of football music at all when I'm there.
Yeah.
And I can translate all of that nonsense inside me to that thing.
Well, there we go. I've just ruined football for Bernard. We have another guest doing our show.
You've made it more exciting for me, though, always. We do. Katie Puckrick is a writer, broadcaster and legend of TV show The Word, of course. Most recently, she's been covering the history of the modern world. Yes, that. Through the portal that is We Didn't Start the Fire, a song by Billy Joel, on her podcast of the same name. Hello, Katie. Welcome to the Culture Bunker.
Hi. I feel like I now need to get into football because Bernard did such a wonderful pitch. He turned it from a dunderhead exercise into an egghead endeavor, and I'm all about pretension and eggheadedness. So.
Careful, though, Katie. Yeah, just careful how we go with this.
I feel the sports bunker coming on. We could all go to a match.
Yeah.
I need some fellow Leeds fans. Anyway, never mind about that. We Didn't Start the Fire. Can you tell our listeners who may not be au fait with it what it's all about?
Well, it's a hop, skip and a jump through the heroes and villains of the late 21st century through the prism that is the maestro Billy Joel and his 1989 hit song, We Didn't Start the Fire. So you may recall that he does this Motormouth rap through Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red, Johnny Ray, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Makes his way through JFK, through Nixon, through punk rock, alludes to Cola Wars, which is an American advertising phenomenon of the 80s. And so every single week, Tom Fordyce and I tackle one of the topics. Currently, it's Brigitte Bardot with an expert. Mm. The expert may be some sort of intellectual. They could be a scholar in the subject. Mm. They could just be a rabid fan. They could be somebody who made a documentary. We had the guy who made a wonderful documentary on Roy Cohn, for instance. Mm-hmm. We spoke to a man whose grandfather was Joseph Stalin's last bodyguard, and so he wrote a book about a memoir about his.
You don't want to be the last bodyguard, do you? You had one job.
He did manage to outlive Stalin. So, in other words, it's just a rock'em sock'em ramshackle stroll through these fascinating topics in a very conversational way. So, check it out.
Now, I believe you had a very, very special guest, though, on your show recently. You had Billy Joel himself.
Yeah, Billy.
How did that happen?
Well, it happened. We were really not expecting this because we thought, we'll get this little show on the road. There's 120 different episodes because his lips are moving quite quickly as he spits out these rhymes. And we thought maybe at episode 70 or 90, we would go cap in hand to Billy in Long Island. But in fact, the day after the very first episode dropped, which was the Harry Truman one, we heard from his PR. Mm. He said, Billy loves it. And when can he come on? We're like, keen. And of course, it was right in the height of the pandemic. So I guess he has a monthly, like, you know how musicians have like a monthly gig at the local pub or something? His local pub is Madison Square Garden. So that's where he just like has a little standing venue, a little place to go. Yeah. And that had shut down. So I guess he had time on his hands.
Okay.
Well, it didn't. Then he had some sort of song and dance about, I can't find my headphones. That's what he said to us.
Yeah.
So then we thought, oh, okay, read between the lines. Maybe he's got cold feet. Anyway, he did show up, and it was delightful. However, I think by the time that we chatted to him, in our heads, he was our best friend. You know, when you just invoke, like, as Billy said, you know, Billy loves Brigitte Bardot. Like, we're, you know, we just sort of feel like we're all buddies. And, of course, we're completely new and strange to him. So I gave him this big intro, you know, the Langoustine of Long Island, the, you know, the bruiser from the Bronx, Billy Joel. And then there was this deathly silence in his studio back in Long Island where he just sort of paused and cleared his throat and... Oh, I've never had an introduction like that before. So it took him a little while to warm up, but we got there. I don't know why he was so backwards and coming forward, but we did actually make a little news with him, and he confessed. He gave us some stories behind some of the lyrics, including the fact that as a 12-year-old, when a Brigitte Bardot film would come on television, he would like run to the hall phone, because this would have been in the 50s, call up his little 12-year-old mates, and they'd all coordinate to get in front of the like the 12-inch screen, because there could be a nip slip. You know, it's Brigitte Bardot. We hear she's going to get into a bathtub.
Oh, Billy.
There could be nipple.
Okay.
Good Lord. Was that allowed in the 50s? Probably not. I shouldn't imagine it was.
I don't think it's allowed now. Anyway, before we crack on, a tiny reminder. You can get The Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without adverts when you support The Bunker on Patreon. That means episodes on politics, science, pop culture and much more every day. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
Let's start with our special guest, bona fide axe hero and award-winning production genius of British music, Bernard Butler. Bernard first came to prominence with Suede in the early 90s, bringing The Riff back on glam racket smashes like Animal Nitrate and Metal Mickey, and The Concept album back with Dogman Star. Since then, he's maintained a Stakhanovite work rate, making Tamla rock and roll hits as 50% of McConnell and Butler, playing with the band Trans and everyone from Amy Mann, The Libertines and The Pretenders to Mark Owen from Take That, and creating a truly vast production catalogue. He contributed to Duffy's huge album Rock Ferry and has produced Frankie and the Heartstrings, Edwin Collins, Paloma Faith, Charmin Spiteri, Tellyman and many more. This month, Bernard does something not many people have done before. He is re-releasing his debut album, People Move On, from 1998, having re-sung the vocals on every track. And here is one of them. This is the new vocals version of Not Alone from People Move On. Bernard Butler, what made you want to redo your debut album and revisit the heady days of 1998?
Well, I didn't want to revisit any heady day, and they weren't heady days for me, for sure. And I definitely don't like revisiting at all. I didn't like it.
Yeah. It's a two-er-upper.
I just didn't like it. That's all right.
Bernard, you're supposed to be plugging the album here. Buy my album that I didn't like.
But did you like it back then?
Not really.
Oh. What did you not like about it?
I didn't like the way I sang it. I mean, I just couldn't do it. I didn't know what I was doing. Well, the story of it is I was just asked to make a record, and I just did it and went ahead and spent more and more money and was allowed to spend as much money as I wanted and do all sorts of amazing things and wrote songs which I like, but I'd never sung at all. And I suppose that, you know, everyone knows that if you grow up in a band and or you're at school, you'll be singing for years and singing dreadful songs, or, you know, in garages and church halls and stuff, and you sort of pay your dues in that way. And I didn't do that as a musician. So when it came to delivering words, I didn't really have a clue. I didn't really think it through.
Yeah.
I wanted to do it. And I feel now when I listen back to it that it sounds quite affected. That's the thing that comes across to me. It's quite affected, like I'm trying to assume a delivery, which is also okay, because I think that's from Bill Joel to all the greats. People do assume a personality.
Yeah.
I think that's all right, but I just didn't assume. I didn't assume well, I don't think, at the time. How I got to it this year is because a couple of years ago, during one of the midlife crises, I started going to, actually just across the road from where we are now, I started going to a rehearsal room in Holloway on my own on a Wednesday afternoon where no one else was, and it's a pretty crap place and it's now closed. And I started going there, and I thought, I'm going to go there, I'm going to try and find out what I've been doing for 30 years, and I'm going to try and put together all the music that I've been playing by memory. And I got into this idea of, I read a lot about this as well, the idea of memory and projection and taking parts of ideas without going back and reading. So in other words, not going back and listening to songs or listening to lyrics or writing chords down or any of those kind of things and trying to learn things. I was thinking, what is my scattered memory of things so I can gather my own kind of history of stuff? And a lot of that is to do with the fact that I made, like you say, list off lots of fairly disparate artists I've worked with, you know, that all sound very different, you know, production wise. So I thought, what is the thread of all of it? Why am I in it, basically? That was the idea.
Yes.
What am I doing here and where am I? You know, what's the point of it? So I thought the most pure way of finding that is, first of all, through the voice, and first and secondly, musically, the most pure element is just a guitar or a piano. So I just chose an electric guitar. So I just spend every Wednesday afternoon for about a year on my own doing that.
Yeah.
And I'd record it on my phone and I'd go home and I'd listen to it back and I'd think, I quite like some of these. You know, so I started to quite like it again, you know, because I never listen to anything I do and I don't like listening to anything I do. I'm not really interested in it.
Yeah.
So it's like looking in the mirror, you know, or looking at pictures of you when you're young or something. You're just like, oh, Christ. And then you go back and look in the mirror and you're like, God, I don't know which is worse now, that haircut or this one. Or, you know, so, so yeah, crises. And, you know, so I started liking it again.
Yeah.
And I started thinking, well, I'm singing this with a singular sort of thread. And because I've been doing this for a year now on my own, I'm quite liking the way I'm delivering this. Suddenly there was a singular sound and it was the sound of a tragic middle-aged man being whatever I am, you know, now, and whatever I've become. Just completely coincidentally, the Demon, the reissue company, kept asking me, will you reissue this? And I said, right, okay, stop asking me. I've got an idea. And will you let me do it if I re-sing it? And they just said, all right. So, and here I am.
Did you find, because this was very much your This Is Me record, stepping out from, you know, you'd done Suede, you'd done McCormick and Butler, you'd done a lot of production, but it's extremely personal and, you know, people move on as a statement as well as an exhortation. People change, you know, you become a different person. Did it feel strange to sing the things that you'd been thinking in 1997? And did you think, who is this guy? He's going through a lot.
You just project it in a different way. That's the interesting thing. You just suddenly like, well, so songs are never about anything. That's a lie when we say that this song's written about this. You know, like you guys will ask somebody like me, what's that song about? And of course, I'll tell you a story and it's not true. Because all songs are scattered ideas and connected with the present and with a memory and with an idea.
Yeah.
And that context changes, you know, over time. And in the same way, if I listen to songs now, I just think, well, I don't really know what that was about. And also, I can change lyrics. I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, I can't remember this, so I'll write something good, you know, now that means something now. So I did a bit of that. And you're just sort of projecting yourself. And by having a different voice, different tone, just by being lived in a little bit, you project something different onto the words. I think this record was quite sentimental and quite emotional drive to it when I was young, because a lot of emotional stuff happened to me in my 20s when I was young.
Yeah.
Like a bit of a roller coaster and a car crash. Can you crash a car on a roller coaster?
Oh, that would be very dangerous.
If I had, I probably it's probably actually quite true to what happened to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't. There weren't times I enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed getting older a lot more. And but they were so very emotionally charged. And at the time, I think I viewed it as quite too emotional. And now I kind of view it as like, well, those are quite good things. Mm. And they're easier to talk about. So the context of there's a lot of references to introversion and cocooning and being solitariness. Fragility, stuff like that, which at the time of the heady days of Britpop was just a little bit like, on your bike, mate.
Yeah.
That's what?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't allowed
at all. We're all supposed to be partying down the Met Park.
We were partying. And I wasn't. I was hiding, you know, behind the sofa pretty much. So, and I think those things are all right now.
Yeah.
You know, they're okay to talk about. So I'm all right going back to it. Going back to it now, I think, oh, that was all right after all, a lot of it. I don't like all of it.
Yeah. You're one of the standout great British guitarist of the past 30 years. Can you remember when you first started to play? Were there tennis racket years before you actually kind of took it up for real?
I played the violin for about 5 years when I was quite young, from about 7 to 14. This is the story you'll want and you won't believe, but it's just true. I was listening to John Peel's show, as my brother used to play at night before he went to bed, and I heard The Smiths and I heard Reel Around the Fountain. My brother's bought a guitar cheap off their mate And they gave it to me and they said, here, you learn this because you know about music, because I play violin, and then teach us so that we can sort of, and of course I never gave it back. So, and that's it. And I just learned to play records. Yeah. So that's all I did. All the records, you know, and I was blessed at that time. It was amazing times. People talk about the golden periods of the 60s and all those kind of things, but that didn't interest me growing up in the 80s. Mm. I had Johnny Marr, Bernard Sumner, Edwin Collins, Robin Guthrie, Will Sargent, Roddy Frame. I mean, there was just a whole host of extraordinary musicians, incredibly characterful. And that was all I listened to. I didn't listen to Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and any of that stuff. Nothing before 1983. Because you wouldn't when you were growing up at that time. Mm. It wasn't cool.
Well, actually, also, you couldn't find it because buying old records was not yet possible, was it? Mm. Unless you went digging around record fairs.
My big brother, he did all the music for me. He brought all the records into the house. And he also brought in things that are really key. He also brought in Miles Davis, which Sketches of Spain, really, it's really important. It always has been. And because gluing that together with Aztec Camera or something, I think paints a bigger picture of what happened, you know, how vast your knowledge can become, you know. And this is growing up in, you know, suburban London as well, where everything's just a bit, you know, you don't see anything interesting.
So try growing up in suburban, not London, it's even worse.
Yeah.
Is there a moment you can remember when you thought, you realised, I'm actually quite good at this? When you cracked something, playing along to records and, you know, I worked out
how to learn stuff. So I'd get a record and I'd take it home and I'd listen to it. And those records came out all the time. Smith's records just came out all the time. You'd buy it after school, bring it home. I'd listen to it, think, cool, let's get down to it and learn it. You know, that was the number one priority for me, to make sure I knew it. And then you'd watch the whistle test and the tube and stuff, and you'd video it. And I just watch people's hands. So I just sit and watch, where's your hand? What are you doing there? And I'd learn how to do it, and that's how I learned how to play. And my brother as well, Stephen, again, he was a master live bootlegger. And
Was the thing. I remember going to Electric Ballroom to buy tapes of the Smiths live at wherever you could find them. And it's probably from your brother.
Well, Stephen used to run a few stores in Camden, and I used to work on them sometimes with him. But he'd basically go off into the night on National Express coaches and Tape the Smiths and all those shows on the Queen is Dead tour. New Order was very, very big on New Order. And the beauty of that was, particularly with New Order actually, was that New Order improvised famously because their gear broke down all the time and stuff. Yeah. But they improvised an awful lot around what they did and left the sequences running for 10 minutes whilst they played, and they made up songs. Mm. And that was a big inspiration for me, because you'd get these tapes and you'd hear people live working stuff out and creating and improvising, and things would be different every night.
I remember that, actually. I remember
the
people
jazz element to New Order, which does get overlooked.
I remember people saying, like,
great musicians, like, they'll always underplay their musicianship, but you have to be good to be able to pull that off, and you have to have some guts to stand up and do that night after night, and like, okay, I'm going to make up a lyric, and that's pretty crap, but actually some of those ended up, you know, you have to be pretty great. And I was hugely inspired by New Order, still am, you know. So Stephen used to bring these tapes home in the middle of the night, and so that's really where I learned. I'd listen to these tapes. Also, Johnny's work, it was the Smiths was very multi-layered, but on stage it was one guitar. That was that was the big thing about Suede, really, where that sound developed, because I thought, hang on, you do all this stuff on the record, but when you do it live, you just do it with one guitar. How do you do that? Mm. I need to know how to do that. And I developed that into what I did in the studio. So that became a sort of what I tried to get to grips with.
As a producer, you are very much not of the sit in the control room and say play it faster but slower style, are you? You get involved. Sometimes you end up joining the band. As a job, I mean, the producers I've talked to, they all say it's psychology. You are effectively trying to connect with the person that you're producing and dig things out of them. Do you have kind of ways of connecting with people, you know, to cut out that 3 to 6 month period of making friends that you wouldn't normally?
I really hate the when people bring up the idea of producers creating tensions deliberately, and that's how you get the best out of people. It's not true. It's not true and it's not a good idea to work, particularly with young people, in that way. Mm. And I was treated in that way, and I really resent that. And I've always made it a point to never work in that way with young people. The people who are most inspiring to me, the people who gave me trust and said, you can do this, rather than try to reflect tension. Yeah. So the psychology of it, it's just like doing this. It's we arrive, we have a cup of tea, we start talking about what's going on, and we talk about stuff. We talk about films we're watching or books and stuff like that, you know. And generally, whenever I work with somebody, I'll get to know somebody in that way very quickly. Say, where you know, how did you get here today on your bike? What happened? And it's always some arseholes, you know, tried to knock you off, or you know, the tube, when somebody went under on the tube, you know. And I just write, and I just sit there and I'm thinking, song, 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 you know, because there's lyrics everywhere. And then when people say, well, I don't know what to write about, and I'm like, well, look at what you've told me about your life today. Yeah. You know, everything is happening and you're just telling me, and I'm a stranger and we're going to be strangers again. And I like that. I always like that we're going to be strangers. We're not doing it to, you know, be friends, have dinner, play golf. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're there to do a thing. Mm. I've got my family, I've got my own mates, you know. But when I do this, I like the fact you meet a complete stranger and these weird kind of affairs happen, you know, musical things. And you share all sorts of very deep bonds, and then you just go.
Yeah. You like have had frequent flyers, though. Like, you've made a couple of records with Charlene Spiteri from Texas.
Yeah.
Who have you clicked with fastest and best? You clearly clicked with her.
Charlene's great. Everyone loves Charlene. She's just, she's great. Who I don't know. I work with hundreds of people I love. And I do keep in touch with, I say that, but I don't expect to. I think my expectation isn't that's what we're there to do, you know, to be big mates. I mean, I currently in love with Sam Lee because we've become friends, and I love what he is, and I love what he's doing for the world, you know, and it blows my mind some of the stuff he gets up to. And I'm just like, I'm such a poor human being compared to what you're achieving. And
well, we're going to be playing more of
his tunes.
Changing
himself to roads and all sorts of stuff, and like for my benefit. It's, so I love talking to Sam, and I find him hugely inspiring being around him.
And digging through all the dozens, scores, hundreds of records you've made, I found repeated reference to he made a record with Roy Orbison, which, unless you've got a time machine, Bernard, is a real trick. Which track is this?
What's it called? You May Feel Me Crying. Mm. What happened is I am on a Roy Orbison record. Brian Eno was asked by Barbara Orbison, Roy Orbison's wife, to go through songs that he'd left behind after he died, and assemble a band around it. And he'd recorded all these songs just with a click track and a sort of cheesy keyboard, but him singing, and his voice was beautiful. Mm. Brian Eno assembled a band to record a live track around these songs, and one of them featured me, and so I was put in a room with Brian Eno making jokes about the singer being dead while his wife was in the control room and stuff like that. That's producer tension. But she was there. Barbara's there. I remember I was quite young then, and I remember Barbara Robson being there. I play a red guitar, a big red semi-acoustic Gibson, which I'm very well aware of is famous for. Roy Orbison played also a big red, cherry red Gibson semi-acoustic. When I was young, I was convinced my dad could be Roy Orbison, or could have been, you know. When I was you ever have that when you, you know, because he had the brilliant quiff and pair of Ray-Bans and stuff, and I just thought, what if, you know, that could have happened. And so I always had a bit of a sort of a thing about Roy Orbison. Anyway, when I met when I was there at the studio, and Barbara did, she said, my husband's had one of those guitars, and I'm like, yeah, no shit. Yeah, I think I know that. Yeah, I've seen that. And she was just looking at the guitar, and I was like, okay, time to go home now.
I believe you made a record with Altered Images. Tell us about this. How did this happen? Because that's real pop music.
Yeah, Claire lives on my road. Mm. So we're neighbours, and she has been forever, you know, for a long time. But yeah, it's got around to wanting to make another record, and said, oh, we should do some writing, and we wrote a song. And it evolved during that time. She's written with Charlene as well, and a few other people, Bobby Bluebell. We wrote a couple of songs, and it's become an Altered Images record. I love Altered Images. I loved Claire, I love Altered Images. I loved Gregory's Girl. I was one of those young men who grew up with Gregory's Girl, thinking it's the greatest thing ever, and that story. And always loved Claire, and I always think they made really fantastic records, particularly their last record, Bites, which I think is a fantastic pop record. Yeah. And I love Claire. She's just great, and Steve, they're just lovely people. So yeah, we live on the, yes.
And this is coming out shortly then, is it?
I don't know when it's quite soon. I've written two songs of Claire, and
great.
Okay, it's good. Super pop is.
Very nice. Well, yeah. Before we move on, we've got a track from that Sam Lee record that you produced recently. This is The Garden of England, open brackets, Seeds of Love, close brackets. It is a little bit Bert Jansch-y, and you are a patron of the Bert Jansch Foundation, aren't you?
I am.
Tell us about this record.
Well, Sam, I knew for quite a long time, and I'd sort of did some near misses with him, and we kept meeting. Mm. And I think Sam, we had a sort of connection, and he's quite wary of the folk tradition of Aaron Jumpers and finger-picking guitar and stuff like that, quite rightly, even though he's a guardian of folk song. But it's his way of interpreting what that is in the modern world. So he came to me and said, well, look, we've put all these songs together and do you want to record it? But I don't think it's going to be, I want guitar. And I was like, this is great. I love that. Mm. People saying that to me. I did end up playing a bit of guitar on it. It was a really beautiful thing. We're really extraordinary musicians. We sat in Sam's front room for a few weeks with no microphones, just planning arrangements of these songs, and their interpretations of songs which Sam has finished in some ways. Mm-hmm. During this process, one of the songs, The Moon Shines Bright, had written, scored at the bottom, Elizabeth Fraser? And I just said, what's that? You know when he says Elizabeth, he says, Oh, that's my friend Elizabeth. Do you know her? And I said, what you mean Elizabeth Fraser from the Cocteau Twins? Mm. He said, oh yeah, I don't know them well. And I said,
have you heard of them?
Yeah, I know Elizabeth Fraser from the Cocteau Twins. Oh, well, I don't know her actually, what you know. And he said, oh, she came to see me and she's really nice. Should we get her to sing? And I was like, let's do that, Sam.
Yeah,
Let's do that, Sam. Yeah. So one of my favourite moments is halfway through recording or towards the end, it was on off whether Elizabeth was going to do this or not, sing a verse in The Moon Shines Bright. I'd been out of an evening with my wife and had a couple of refreshments and came home on a Friday night and got this email from Elizabeth with her voice, and I just half drunk put it on. I was like, oh my Lord, I'm listening to this and it's beautiful. And then she phoned me really late at night and said, you know, just delete it, it's rubbish. And I said, okay, I'll talk to Sam about it. I'm like, of course I'm not going to delete it, you crazy lady. And anyway, yes, so we recorded Elizabeth Fraser and it was a really beautiful experience. I love Sam. The musicianship is just, I love being around people where I'm just in awe, you know, and I was just in awe of the bass player. To other people it just doesn't register, but that's I just watch people and think you're so great and it inspires me and you're so talented and I want to buy you. You know, I want to keep you under my bed or something. Yes. And so it was that experience with Sam, and I'm hoping to do another record with him now.
Well, let's have a listen to this track from that album. This is The Garden of England, Seeds of Love by Sam Lee.
For they must be bound to be free, light working the liminal, listening to the land and fingering at mystery. Not Sally, free and easy. Oh grief, why the songs they go.
Right, let's talk about TV and art. Andy Warhol's America is now on the BBC on iPlayer. It's a three-parter exploring the artist's beginnings in Pittsburgh, his illustration career, onto his early screen prints, and everything you probably know already. What does the tale of the man who made pop art popular land in the post-post-post-post-modern world of 2022? What new things do we learn? Let's listen to the trailer.
Brillo, Campbell Soup, Marilyn Monroe, all the things that he saw as in America. He loved beauty, he loved fame.
That's beautiful.
But he also portrayed the American dream turned nightmare.
Andy Warhol's art shows the violence, the utter disdain for human life in the United States.
Andy was really both glorifying and critiquing American culture and the whole American system.
Director Francis Whatley also gave us David Bowie, Finding Fame, and Bowie 5 Years. Also, Dolly Parton documentaries and many more music documentaries. Do we really need to delve into the social context behind Andy Warhol and his time? Katie?
Oh, I think we absolutely need to delve into the context of Andy Warhol because he predicted everything that's happening right now. I mean, he predicted people as brands. himself as a brand, Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor, Mao Zedong. He predicted influencers with the superstars that he cultivated, absolutely ordinary people who were just lurking around the silver factory as he was making his silk screen prints, and he turned the camera on them and turned them into quote-unquote stars. He invented reality TV with a screen test, whether it was Dennis Hopper or Bob Dylan dropping by the factory, he'd train a camera on them and just let them be who they were going to be. The fetishization of fame. In the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. Pocket technology. His whole thing was to, if he wasn't photographing or filming everything, he took his little portable tape recorder with him to every glitzy party, to Studio 54, to meeting the Shah of Iran, hanging out with Bianca and Jerry. And he called his tape recorder his wife. So he himself felt that he was not interesting enough, or he wasn't interested in himself. He was interested in everybody else. So that whole idea of recording everything around you and then blurring the lines between advertising and entertainment, which is what he did, and also blurring the lines between business and art. And he called his magazine, Interview Magazine, business art. And he called getting commissions to do portraits for the great, the good, the beautiful, and the oligarchs and the war criminals, he called that business art because he felt that making money was art.
So what does this program do? Who do we have, for instance, as the talking heads? And what do they reveal that we wouldn't already know? Because obviously Andy Warhol is someone that we are familiar with.
Yeah, so we're familiar with the image that he portrayed of himself and that he allowed. And he was definitely controlling that image. So he was somebody who had kind of poor health. He had terrible skin. I think he had a little bit of a nose job, or at least he had his nose sanded.
He had it sanded.
Yeah, it was kind of
before
like
they really knew how to do nose jobs.
Yeah, microdermabrasion. So he was very self-conscious about his nose, and then he was losing his hair, and then he decided he was the master of turning limitations into strengths. So he felt that, you know, he wasn't the greatest draftsman, so that's why he turned, you know, he did beautiful drawings of shoes and also penises. Maybe there's a little crossover with both of those shapes. But that's why he ended up working with silkscreen, because it was something that could be endlessly reproduced. And so also with his hair, hair wasn't really there. So then he decided, okay, I'm just going to get a series of gray mops and I will look the same for the rest of my life. So in answer to your question, he very much controlled his image. But what we get from this documentary are people who worked with him. So Bob Colicella, who edited Interview Magazine early on and was an intimate of his, Gerard Malanga, who was the whipcracker in the Exploding Plastic Inevitable that the Velvet Underground were a part of. And then he ended up being Warhol's first assistant, making the silkscreen prints, and was a poet as well. You have Jane Holzer, who was a dilettante rich lady. She was known as Baby Jane Holzer at the time. So these are all intimates who worked with him, who were able to say, these are his vulnerabilities. He acted like he was completely starstruck and shy. Like there was a funny clip that showed him on the Merv Griffin show with Edie Sedgwick, where he's whispering into Edie Sedgwick's ear every time Merv has a question. And that's something that someone like Prince used to do in his later years when he was going through his slave years. So you see somebody, what you learn is somebody who is so clever and subtle at manipulating pop culture. So so he understands that people, especially in the 60s, are getting used to this idea of consumption and ease. You know, everybody can have a bowl of a piping hot Campbell's soup, you know, just by, you know, reaching into the cupboard and pulling one of any, you know, 25 different flavors. But he was an expert at taking this commodification of culture and then putting his own spin on it.
Bernard, before the show, we talked about context on this, and you said you really enjoyed it. But has it got enough context about some of the pop artists around at the time? Because here we are, have Andy Warhol invented everything, and it's all his idea. But what did you think in terms of social history, but also art history?
Well, I think the social history was the biggest part of it, and Andy Warhol's America being important. And I think I like the fact that it didn't mention the Velvet Underground until halfway through the second episode, which is quite rare with anything, that everything tends to be focused on the factory and nothing around it. And so I also liked hearing about his him growing up and what happened in the 70s as well. But there is a little bit of a gap of what his inspirations were rather than is the sense is that everything was taken from the culture of the time and he absorbed everything around him and that was it. And it doesn't focus at all really, as you say, on the other pop artists. There was actually a really great film a few weeks ago about surrealism by
Philippa Perry.
That's right. Yeah, I was just trying to remember. Yeah. And that was really great. And that did talk about the surrealists going to New York and the crossover and Jackson Pollock and how that became modernism actually and because why they ended up in New York and getting away from the horrors of Germany. I think there's a thread there which is quite interesting in that he didn't maybe invent everything, but you know that's all right because I think the idea of being a sponge and absorbing everything around you is powerful enough with Warhol. As a film, again, it's that idea of a projection. It's a film is projecting an idea of an artist, and the artist is projecting an idea of his times and the culture around him. And so it goes on and on. It's like Russian dolls, you know, one inside of another. And I guess it's whose truth you believe, or is it just a sense of what do we enjoy? And the films were brilliantly done for a start, just like
so beautifully done.
I thought that the interviews of Gerard Malanga were—he's brilliant.
Yeah.
He was brilliant then, and he's still just quite animated.
Andrew, no one's mentioned Jerry Hall yet.
Yeah, Jerry Hall.
Why is that important to Andrew?
I don't know. Why is it important to me?
It's important to the discussion. It's your turn next, Andrew.
Well, I mean, Jerry Hall, insight.
I'd like to add mention Jerry Hall. There's a funny little detail in Bob Colicella's book about Warhol where he talks about the fact that there was this crossover between when Mick Jagger was married to Bianca, and then he started going out with Jerry, and both women thought that "Miss You" was about them. So they drop by the factory and go, "Oh, you know Mick's new song. It's about me." It's like, I don't know. It might not be about either of you, ladies.
Exactly.
I enjoyed this. Bear's right about the social context is kind of the thing that drives it.
Yeah.
What I liked about it was it wasn't entirely uncritical. You do meet people who were quite seriously damaged by their time at the factory or who knew people who were that seriously damaged and didn't survive. The breakdown of it into the three episodes, effectively episode one is pop art and the rise and how he goes from Pittsburgh to being a sought after very, very highly paid illustrator.
Yeah, 100 grand a year.
Part two is the factory in the Velvet Underground. And part three is how the sort of late period kind of dissolution into... You know, essentially, it is all just about the money. What it highlighted was, I mean, obviously, Warhol achieved some amazing things, but he also kind of institutionalized this idea that what the art world is about is celebrating meaninglessness.
Mm.
And we see a lot of art crowd party footage of people who, at some removal, look rather ridiculous, talking about the wonders of the emptiness of Warhol and how great it is. Obviously, that was a moment that art was going through at the time. But I think what he did helped to institutionalize some of the worst aspects of the art world.
The Jeff Koonsiness.
And also the fact that he had the electric chair. He took a photo of the electric chair that the Rosenbergs were electrocuted in, turned it into beautifully colorized silk screens, baby pink, you know, light blue, lemon yellow. And there's actual wonderful clips, archive clips of people at shows going, "Oh, that one's so pretty, the pink electric chair." Absolutely punk rock. And then he's asked, you know, "Why did you do this? Why did you choose such a provocative image?" And he just says, "Oh, it's just beautiful.
But we don't see, at no point do the art world kind of hangers-on and critics say, "Why is it beautiful, Andy?" He's expert at deflecting any kind of interrogation. You can't sort of imagine a future in which that subculture didn't emerge. It was going to happen. It was going to be driven by Warholism. But it has given us what the art world is now, which is kind of a self-replicating little bubble that doesn't really have much to say about real life.
That particular part of it. It has Larry Gagosian in here. And the good thing is they skirt over the fact that his pieces cost a lot of money because it's meaningless. It doesn't, you know, it's not here for the documentary. It's not about art and commerce in that sense and what these things are meant now. I enjoyed that bit. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine a world where Warhol didn't exist. I don't think that you can. I wanted a bit more, well, here's Cindy Sherman and here is Jeff Koons and what they are taking from it. And I wanted a bit more of the modern context of how art now couldn't exist in the way that it does. Just in a commerce way.
I think that's probably a different documentary.
Well, maybe.
I think, and I'd like to make it.
It feels like that's dropped in the last 5 minutes of episode three. Just, and by the way, this, and it goes back to the Burger
There's
King.
There's a montage,
advert.
Isn't there? A Big Brother and all those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but that kind of happens in the last 5 minutes. Yeah. And so this is what you've been doing for 3 hours.
Right.
Scrolling your phone, probably.
And you referenced, Bernard, the Burger King advert, which was just actually, it was turned into a Burger King ad, but it was just him very slowly in real time unwrapping fast food hamburger from Burger King and eating it, complete with ASMR sound effects, the crinkle of the paper and the chewing. I mean, he invented ASMR.
Yeah, maybe he did.
But it's all consumed in the end by business. It's all consumed by capitalism. That is what I found.
I found it reminded me how...
Art.
Oh, it reminded me, though, of how shocking he can be and actually how edgy and the electric chair stuff.
But there was there were a couple of moments where there were people who were protesting in a way. There were the lady who was not impressed by the race riots scenes.
Yeah.
And quite rightly. Yeah. There was an awful lot of fawning art people being how wonderful, just saying all the things that I knew already.
Yes.
And there was a few moments where people said, actually, you know what, he's making money out of that. And do I care about his art when he's making money? And I think that's completely justified.
That
was kind of dropped in and it was a little bit shocking, but then pushed over a little bit. The other one was Wilhelmina, the story of him,
that's very
her,
tragic, isn't
which
it?
Is really tragic. Yeah. And but you know what? There was probably a hell of a lot of tragic stories.
Yeah.
There were
lot of damaged people, including him. And it does sort of gloss over that as well, the idea that he did revel over.
But then maybe that's a different documentary. That's what we're saying. We would broadly recommend, though.
It's worth watching. As regular listeners know, we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite tune. Katie Puckrick, you're not getting out of this one. What have you chosen and why have you chosen it?
There's somebody who's come on my radar recently, Neil Francis. He's from Chicago. He's a piano player. He plays very 70s-style piano rock, kind of hints of the Kinks, and Elton is in there. He actually reminds me of Nicky Hopkins, who was the big session pianist who played on all the classic Kinks and Rolling Stones albums in the 60s and 70s. Neil Francis's album is called In Plain Sight, and I find it very reminiscent of Hopkins' 1973 LP, The Tin Man Was a Dreamer, because it's very idiosyncratic and ramshackly, lots of personality, very melodic. So the song of Neil Francis's that I've picked from In Plain Sight is called Alameda Apartments.
And as much as it hurts, it remains to this day that I love her, and that stays just the same. And people ask if it hurts, but I stoop so low. And in the end, I let it go. And as much as it hurts, it remains to this day that I love her, and that stays just the same.
Now, this time last year, we were marvelling at what a good actor that young man Ollie Alexander was in Russell T Davis's It's a Sin. He used to be the frontman of the band years and years. Now he's the sole owner-operator of that act, and their third album, Night Call, his first as a solo artist, is out next Friday. Unfortunately, this being a major release, we can't clear tracks to play on the podcast, but we're going to drop the single Sweet Talker into the rolling playlist. Casey, you started your pop career under the tutelage of the Pet Shop Boys as a dancer on the performance tour in the early 90s. Ollie is also under the tutelage of the Pet Shop Boys. He made a record, he made Dream. And in fact, Bernard did Burning the Heather with the Pet Shop Boys.
I think we're on the same record.
It's on the same record.
We may
spot.
Be.
Yeah. It's all coming together. What did you think of the Years and Years album?
Well, it's not my bag. Mm-hmm. It's, it's just so heavily processed. The vocals, the sound so deeply compressed. The whole thing is like a pop music panini. It's just kind of smushed. It's delicious and smushed and probably very bad for you. It is like a blend of Justin Timberlake and Kylie, but less good than that suggests. Just not my bag. But the thing that I find very enchanting is that Ollie Alexander is just so good at being a pop star. You know, he's so happy to be there. He's not trying to do some sort of begrudging mystery persona stance. He is just a show poodle, loud and proud. And so I love that about him. You know, really good at what he does. It's just, I find that it was just a symposium of cliches. It's just kind of like, sort of 80s sounds, 90s sounds. It's like all your favorite sounds just kind of run through at top speed. So it's almost like, hey, what was happening in pop music from 1980 to 2021? I don't know. Listen to this album and find out.
You've listed all the reasons I liked it, actually. And you're right. He is a very good pop star. Mm. He actually looks like a pop star, which not very many people do these. He's, you know, and the cover illustration of this where he's a merman is particularly hilarious, I thought.
Yeah.
He says it's a hookup record. I put all the kind of stuff I was missing, like going out, dancing and having sex. I put it all into the record.
Well, I don't know about the sex stuff. I mean, it's kind of a tsunami of sameness because it's just so like relentlessly, you know, bam, 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 upbeat, upbeat, like not exploding with tunes, but more like sounds, a collection of easy to digest sounds.
Bernard, I mean, you've never really done the big electronics panoply thing, have you? You've always been based in like physical instruments kind of thing. What's your position on the years and years thing?
I kind of agree with Katie, actually, and I wish it was more blatantly about sex and hookups because I felt it was just really, if that's what his story is, just full of lyrical cliche, quite bland cliches, which are quite average. I think it's a really good tune. Yeah. I really love the string part in it. You know, it's quite uplifting, but I just want it to be more daring.
Yeah.
You know, and I think him as a person, he has the position as a pop star. They're pretty big now to do something pretty daring and to experiment and to use that platform. And I find it really, I find it really annoying when somebody's got that platform and just produces a Spotify 2:56 song that starts at the start and it ends, there's no fade. There's just nothing experimental about it. And you have to look at Pet Shop Boys when they had their moment at that time when they were biggest pop stars in the world. They were absolutely doing extraordinary things. I don't think it was the tour that I saw you on, but I definitely saw several dates on the tour where It's a Sin was being performed and Neil would be carried on dressed as a cardinal.
Yes.
Was that your
tour? No. We were all schoolboys.
Just before. Yes.
We were praying and masturbating at the same time.
Good for you, yeah. And, you know, but those people, Neil and Chris, were fantastic pop stars for that reason, because they experimented and they used the platform, but with joyous, melodic music that hit the mainstream.
Mm.
And they knew it still hit people.
Yeah.
And I wish that this guy did this on this. I would love him to do it, but it's not. It's a bit bland.
Maybe the two of you need to get together, Bernard.
He wouldn't listen to me.
Tough love.
He wouldn't listen.
Tough love.
Yeah.
Sean, what did you think? And there's some quite good writing to the title here, 20 minutes, about how a quick hookup can change your life and you can actually fall in love with somebody after 20 minutes. Or look at all that muscle getting me into trouble. What did you think of it?
It's very much the nephew of the Scissor Sisters, isn't it? He's taking that baton. And also, he is Kylie. I mean, Kylie is one of the heroes and they've worked together before, but that's what he's doing. It's similar to disco in that sense that you can tell this is a locked up person who really, really needs to get out to the club. And I loved it for that. I put it on in the morning, and Consequences, the first track on it, is an absolute banger.
Mm.
But Bernard is very right. In song structure, you know, when you've listened to the first 20 seconds, you know how the rest of the song is going to go. Mm. It is verse, chorus, middle eight.
I want to hear the mistakes. If he's talking about mistakes in his life and being a human being,
so they need to be musically.
I want to hear that musically, and I don't. I hear something that's I could knock up in logic right now in about 45 seconds.
But I have a massive fondness for him. I'm also glad he's still alive after It's a Sim, because
it's not real, you know.
I know, you know that point where he's such a gorgeous person. You know that he is just all good. A bit of an edge to it, a bit of some rougher
edges. Keep at it, be a bit weirder.
Be a bit weirder, but he is rather lovely, Ollie.
Bernard Butler, it's your turn to share your current favourite tune with us. What have you chosen and why?
I've chosen The Weather Station, which is an album from last year, and a song called Rubber.
Yeah.
It could have been many songs in this album. I really love this record. I really love the record before this as well, by The Weather Station, which I've discovered in the last few years. It's a lady called Tamara Linderman. It's an awkward record that sounds really beautiful. So somebody who's expressing some quite awkward ideas about modern life and her modern life, in a really beautiful, with emotional context. I like it. That's all. I always think of my mum listening to music and think, turn it up, turn it off. That's all the stuff we're saying is brilliant, but you turn it up or you turn it off.
I'll turn it up. Here it is. This is The Weather Station with Rubber. But the robber never believed in you. You were two halves of the same piece.
Finally, copy that. In a new psychological thriller from Indonesia, photocopier, student Sarani goes for a big night out in Jakarta to celebrate with her theatre group friends. But when a drunken selfie appears online, it costs her a scholarship and a whole lot more. We're going to listen to the trailer. Of course it's not in English, but it will give you a bit of atmosphere. Here's photocopier.
Kamu ini kerap acap kali atau gemar pergi ke diskotik?
Tak berkelakuan baik maksudnya apa?
Tapi Sur berhak merayakan kemenangan Sur, Pak.
Biasiswa lu hilang, Tong. Karena kelakuan lu yang gak baik.
Gue mesti cari bukti kalau gue dikerjain.
Gue mau nyolong data dari HP anak-anak. Mungkin gak ya, Kak? Kalau minuman saya dikasih obat.
The film had its world premiere at the 26th Busan International Film Festival and it scooped many, 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 many awards before it came to Netflix. Andrew Harrison, what did you think of this?
I thought it was really good. I was really fascinated by it. I like the fact that Netflix is basically shoving an art house cinema into your telly and making things available that otherwise are very, very hard to get to see, particularly if you're not in Ponzi London like we are. It is incredibly vivid. It is a very powerful evocation of the internet shaming trope, which is made more powerful by the fact that it's taking place in a different culture where shame has a different function. And, you know, she has an exceedingly domineering father.
Yes.
And it's particularly interesting that possibly because of local mores in Indonesia, the internet shaming is not shown as explicitly sexual. It's only hinted at. Whereas if this were made in Britain or America, it would be explicitly sexual.
Yes.
And the fact that it isn't tells us quite a lot, not just about the society that's being depicted, but also about Indonesian cinema. The performances, although, I can't understand what anybody's saying, but the performances are powerful. Mm-hmm. It is essentially the story of how within a university community, a university creative community in Jakarta, a kind of a cult is formed without people realising they're in a cult.
Yes.
Charismatic power, and in a way it connects with Warhol, the idea that art justifies everything, allows, without too many spoilers, people to get away with terrible, terrible things. And who does the blame fall on? It falls on women again. So I thought it was great. It looks incredible as well.
Yes, it looks absolutely beautiful. Katie, you've seen a little bit of this. Is it about a patriarchal society?
The thing I like about it is that it's so refreshing to be immersed in a completely different culture and realize, maybe this is not so refreshing, that there's the same old shit.
That's what I think.
The vulnerable and that women have to deal with. I did watch it very quickly all the way through at 1.25 speed. I am a speed reader. There were subtitles, but it is very easy on the eye. The acting is compelling. And the thing that I was struck by, it's called photocopier, and there's this idea that, you know, at the end, information, righteous information is disseminated throughout the community. And it's almost like the power of the printer, the printing press.
Yeah, it's very you know, ultimately analog is the, not necessarily the solution, but analog is the thing that brings this particular story to a kind of resolution.
Yeah.
And it's very modern. The internet shaming takes place through shared phones and through networking sites and all the rest of it, but also other motors of the story are, for instance, fast ride sharing, instant ordering of, you know, of taxis and other digital services, which obviously girdles the globe now. The idea that we're just, it's only us here in the West, with our, you know, dominated by our little machines.
And yet at the end, the thing that is pulling everybody together is to the power of the written word. Like physically, you see a hand on a piece of paper writing down things and then photocopying them and then pieces of paper in the air. I mean, I think it's just so interesting that it really does come down to the power of communication, you know, just out of our face and into your ear.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the autonomy of that against the digital data, which you lose all autonomy on. I thought there were parallels with Parasite, White Tiger, White Lotus. I could go on. And there are, there's quite a few modern films talking about class. Often in the covert way more than it's in the main deal. This is about a class structure in Indonesia. We realise this is about who has money and who doesn't and what power that can still yield. Mm. And I thought that that was a really interesting bit about it. Bernard, would you watch this? Is it something you might put on this weekend?
From your reviews?
Yes, from our
I'm interested in actually. Most interested in it, something on Netflix that sounds like it should be on Mubi or something.
I think it's good of Netflix to put it on,
Often when I go to Netflix, I must admit, I've seen everything here, and
Before we go, every week we ask our guests to choose the greatest songs of all time, and inevitably, being timeless classics, it's really tricky to clear them, so they go straight onto the playlist. Bernard Butler, what have you chosen as the greatest song of all time?
Well,
right now?
I mean, it would change by the second, even in this conversation. I'm thinking, oh my God, why didn't I do this? And, you know, I did have a moment the other night, and I'm thinking, right, I've got to get in touch tomorrow morning and change this. It's different. And I realised I haven't got a favourite song of all time at all. By tonight, about 10 o'clock, it would definitely be Casey and the Sunshine Band's or something like that, or Dancing Queen or something like that. What I thought would be good to fit on the playlist was Epic Soundtracks. And this is a song called Fallen Down. I don't know a great deal about Epic Soundtracks. I know some scattered parts of his life. And one of them that always interested me is we lived in the same part of London at the same time and I didn't know him. And it always bothers me that I may have known this person at that time. So he lived in West Hampstead at the time I lived there and I was recording. And I think that he was in quite a state at the time. He didn't come to a very good ending.
Right.
But it's a beautiful, beautiful record about the song that it feels to me about exclusion and misunderstanding and all those sort of tragic circumstances put to a really beautiful song. I just really love it, and I'd like more people to hear this record.
Well, they will, because they're all going to go to the playlist right now and listen to it.
Good.
Katie Puttrick, what's your choice for the greatest record of all time, literally?
Well, the greatest record of all time this week in my head, I just cannot get it out of my head. It just popped in there. It's a Blondie track. It's from their Plastic Letters LP, and I think that's from like 77, 78. It's the album that Denis came from, but it's the opening track in the album. It's called Fan Mail, and it's this wonderful song. It's totally power pop, and I'm a big power pop ophile, and it has this like really bombastic swagger. It's very stoppy, starty. It has kind of a stutter built into it, and then once it gets into this little middle 8-bit. This is almost like Baroque little organy keyboard thing going do do do, you know, sort of 60s. So it goes from like absolute power pop mid-70s into a little bit of like 60s Baroque pop. And then you have Debbie's voice, which is just so girlish and effortless and has such attitude in it, but not in a pretend macho way, like in a total, if there's a word for feminine virility, I don't know what that word is.
We need it.
We need that word.
It's femorility.
Femorility, because she's got it in spades. So it's called Fan Mail, and it's so likable and swaggery and playful and fun. Dig it.
Right, has Fallen Down and Fan Mail go on the Bunker Rollin' 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 playlist. We're at the end of the podcast and it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we take a cue from photocopier and have a whiskey shot and Xerox our birthmarks? Katie.
Well, I have perfume on the brain because I, as you may or may not know, write about perfume. And I'm just starting in the Evening Standard magazine, magazine, next week. I'm going to be the very first perfume columnist.
Fantastic.
All right.
So on the 21st, the first column goes out. And I'm giving you guys a sneak sniff.
Okay.
It's a perfume.
It's
live
the
in the
first
studio.
Scratch and sniff podcast.
I'm spraying on some blotters. Yep. This is by Comme des Garçons, and it is called Ganja.
No way.
Ranking. See what you think.
Well, I don't think it smells like ganja. I'll say that for a start.
Oh, it does.
Maybe I've got COVID and I'm losing my sense of smell. Hang on.
What do you think?
It's an element.
How about you?
I can get the ganja influence.
Okay. Hemp-esque.
And I like it. It's fine. Well done.
Yeah. Oh, it's Comme des Garçons.
Yeah.
And so the bottle's got this little, like, spray painted.
Do we get a bottle?
I'm not smelling that. I'm like, I can't. I've smelled it so hard, I don't know what it means anymore.
You've smelled it so hard. See, that's what someone who's stoned would say.
But you know, like, when you look at a very short word, and after a short period of time, you're like, what are those letters? Are they even shapes? Do they mean anything?
You would admit that it's quite herbal. It's quite green.
Yeah, I like it.
It's bitter. There's a bitterness to it.
There's a rosemary element to it.
Yeah,
it's quite
quite strong.
I sort of
thought it was oregano-ish.
It's
nice.
Yes, it's a sort of green.
Oh, pleasant, yeah. Damning with
pleasant.
Faint praise.
No, no.
But do you not smell the absolute...
I can smell the ganja in it
as
well.
Yeah, ganja, there you go.
Which is the bit that puts me off.
But would you
I can walk down the street and smell that
You'd get a hard look from a Bobby on the beat.
Maybe.
It's fascinating. So listeners can read you.
Yes.
Puckrick on Smells.
Puckrick on Smells is called Message in a Bottle is the column in ES Magazine. Fantastic. It'll be at least once, maybe twice a month. Mm-hmm. And the first one out next week.
I've now inhaled so hard on that I've actually got an oxygen high. I'm going to pass out.
Nice.
Yes.
Bernard, what's your closing time chatter?
You know what? When you asked me this, I thought of the first thing and I stuck to it. And it was a film I was watching late at night called The Garn. I was on BBC Four the other night. And it's about a train journey that goes from southern Australia to northern Australia. Mm. And all that happens is there's a picture. You're on a train and all that happens is you look out the window and you see it. And it's completely beautiful. I've watched it twice now. And that really interests me. I've never been to Australia. Yeah. That's the part one of the parts that interests me. And I like the connection of moving and travelling and the connection with that, with music, with songs and song journeys. I've been reading, kind of a little bit obsessed with Robert McFarlane's Old Ways, which is all about walking and travelling and the stories about song. So when I watch this film, I can watch it late at night and stare at the screen and drift off. And I really like things where nothing happens at
yes.
all.
This
sounds like...
just nothing happens at all. You're just looking out of a train.
When they repeat The Reindeer on BBC Four every Christmas, I watch, you know, The Reindeer Journey that lasts 4 hours?
Can I just plug The Last Igloo, which is a documentary that I had a part of, which again was a man building an igloo over the course of the day in the Arctic Circle.
I don't know if I saw this, but I wanted to watch it. Yeah, that'd be right up my igloo.
That's right. Andrew?
Well, I'm going to bring everybody down with the detail on the latest infamous garden party, or party rather, at number 10.
The work meeting.
Staff partied in the basement of number 10 to music DJ'd by a special advisor. Can you imagine what music DJ'd by a number 10 special advisor would be like? I had these tunes on the laptop, I plugged it in. It's just, it's filling my mind with fear and horror.
Lady in Red?
Yeah. Definitely, but I think it's going to be a nightmare mix of awful bangers like Hi Ho Silver Lining, Sweet Caroline's going to be on there, Simply the Best, Relight My Fire, loads of Rat Pack. It's going to be terrible, isn't it?
Loads of Dino.
I mean, not to knock Sweet Caroline, but in the context
not
of
to not any of them, obviously.
But it's in the just, context of a party in the basement, the basement of number 10 or the upper level of hell. DJ Lexus special advisor, though, available for booking here. DJ Spad. How about yours, Sean?
Well, I'm bringing it down with Ronnie Spector. I just wanted to say RIP.
RIP, Ronnie.
RIP.
To the fabulous Ronnie. Yeah. And what more can you say is what a fantastic human being. And the world is for the better that she was here.
Yes.
And also, it's a nice excuse. I know we can listen to the music, but also look at pictures of her. And she always looked wonderful.
Oh, she just was like the platonic ideal of a street tough bad girl.
Yeah, some of the suits. I now want to replicate some of the suits. I need to go down Carnaby Street or something. There's some really, really good looks there.
I've liked watching when those lots of videos of her performing Be My Baby been everywhere this week. Actually, the audiences, what teenagers look like and kids look like, and sitting down dancing. You know, those kind of, what was that
the
thing?
Hand jive.
What's that thing? Yes. When you do the hand jive. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Dancing with your upper body.
It's bring the it moment back. When you realise, oh my God, that was centuries ago. It really was,
It's another time. And that's the end of the podcast. Thank you so much to Bernard Butler and Katie Puckrick for being with us and joining us here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can get all the tunes on our rolling playlist. The link is at the top of the show notes. Play a song and send an artist 0.00000000, probably some more noughts, 2p. From me, Andrew, producers Alex Rees and Yelena Sofronievich, thank you for listening and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison with Sean Pattenden. The assistant producer was Yelena Sofronievich, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Paper Cuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Paper Cuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. They're like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star, proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Paper Cuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Paper Cuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.